that the church is a, what does it say, is qualified to counsel on ethical issues given its obvious massive ethical problems. I think one thing that was really helpful for me when I became Catholic was how non-defensive the Catholics that I met were and how upfront they were about the church's sordid history. They made it really clear to me that the Catholic Church is not a bunch of people historically gathered in a room. It's not all of us and our mess and sins. The Catholic Church is the bride of Christ. And that the way to know her in her fullness is through, I think it was the then Cardinal Ratzinger who said the only remaining credible witnesses to Christ and to his church are the art produced in her bosom and her saints. And that, I think, is a good way of talking about what I fell in love with in the church. I don't know that this will be convincing to anyone, but if you want to know why I think that the Catholic Church, or why I trust the Catholic Church, in spite of the obvious depravity of the acts of so many Catholics throughout history, including popes, the reason is that this is the Church of the Crucifixion, the Church of the Eucharist, the Church of Michelangelo, the Church of Oscar Wilde by his death, the Church of St. Francis, the Church of Dorothy Day. That, I think, is a credible ethical counselor, but not necessarily your parish priest. That's a different story. So that's at least a gesture toward, or sort of the beginnings of an answer to what I think is a very pointed and pertinent and much broader question. Do you find your Catholic peers to be more or less accepting of sexuality, or your gay friends of Christians? So sort of like, which group, as it were, is best at tolerating the other? I've actually been really lucky. I find that in general, people are open to kind of people who are different from them. So I don't know that I have a sort of hierarchical answer to that question. I'm not, my secular or non-Catholic gay friends have been surprisingly tolerant of me. And I would say at this point, most of my Christian friends are gay and celibate, so that's sort of a, you know, different question. There are way more of us out there than you may realize. And then finally, this is another pretty pointed question that I think is worth throwing out there. If you're encouraging people to dedicate themselves to their church and seek other forms of love, other ways of seeking intimacy, aren't you making them vulnerable to be preyed on by people in the church? For example, as we all know now, that they're predator priests, but I think that can be generalized to other people in positions of authority. I think anybody who is vulnerable and serious about any community is in some way open to being preyed on by that. But if you cut yourself off from community, if you cut yourself off from all authority, and if you cut yourself off from anyone who could hurt you, that life too is not really that great. So I will say that I have not seen that happen to people, but I would not be surprised if it had. All I can say is that the people that I know who have made themselves more vulnerable, more open to their church, have, I think, one, waited until they found a church that they trusted more, and a church community that they trusted more. A lot of these questions are about how can we become that trustworthy community. So one is like, yeah, definitely, wait until you really do feel that you can trust these people. But one other possible protective thing is have more than one community. Don't put all your eggs in one communal basket. So that you don't feel like if someone in this group of friends or this parish hurts me, I have nowhere to go. When I've seen people do that, it's been immensely fruitful for them, that trust and that open-heartedness. I have not seen actually lead to kind of making yourself available for abuse. I will say there are times when making yourself transparent to your church community, I've seen communities treat people badly, and at that point you really, again, do need your friends to be able to tell you, these people are treating you really badly. You don't need this, and there are going to be churches that will treat you well. So that, I think, is a real issue and problem. This is more of a vocabulary question than anything else, because I was super unclear. Can you say more about the difference between an intentional community and a community of caring? So community of caring was just sort of a catch-all term that I was using for a church community where you can trust that people will actually take care of you in your moments of crisis. So that a community where you have someone you can talk to at 2 in the morning, or when you're in the hospital, you won't need to worry about, like, is anyone going to care what's happening to me? Am I totally alone here? That's, I would say, what I mean by a community of caring. And you will notice a few of our churches really fit that description. An intentional community is a small group of typically lay Christians, both Protestant and Catholic, and sometimes crosses denominational boundaries, who choose to live together. So they're typically sharing a household. They share often at least some portion of their finances, some portion of their common life, and often live in service to their local neighborhood. So you would have people who live together and live in one of the poorest neighborhoods in their city and seek to serve the members there. So like the Catholic Worker House actually would be a decent example of an intentional community where people are attempting to build a kind of communal life that is not based around the parish, and not based around a religious order, but is based around an association of lay people. What should be the church's response to the gay marriage decision? I don't know why I put this so high in the pile, because I sort of don't want to answer it. My basic thing is first to recognize the way that we have, that, like, there is no, how to put this, unless the church offers actual structural support for people taking care of one another, you are going to have people people are going to seek secular legal protection. We have not figured out a good way to think in terms of caregiving outside of sexual intimacy, and therefore we leave people feeling that no one will take care of them unless they have essentially a marriage relationship. We've defined marriage as the way that adults care for one another. If the church were to think hard about what are ways that we could protect caregiving, we might be able to find some ways to that's what I'm looking for. Undo some of the conditions that I think made the gay marriage decision almost inevitable. for example, I have friends who are facing really severe economic consequences because they're trying to love and care for one another when their health insurance won't cover the other person unless they're married. Where they're... so that's, I think, one like really visceral thing that people deal with is if we don't have a recognized relationship, we'll be bankrupted. But there's also sort of the question of public honor. Of when I appear in church with this person, am I a stranger to them? Am I considered to be just a stranger or a sort of accessory or acquaintance? Or am I recognized as someone who's part of their family? That, too, I think is a way of making it clear that caregiving in the Catholic Church is not restricted to marriage. Today is actually the feast day of St. Aelred, who wrote the gorgeous dialogues on spiritual friendship. And I think this would be a great opportunity for priests, for example, to offer to bless friends who were to come up and ask for a blessing on their friendship. We do this for mothers on Mother's Day. We do this for groats on St. Blaise's Day. Surely, right, an actual intimate love and caregiving relationship is at least as worthy of blessing as, like, your laryngitis. So, I think thinking creatively about whether we can renew an understanding of caregiving as the central sort of question that a lot of gay marriage proponents are trying to address. It is not the only question, right? And certainly I'm not saying this will satisfy people, but I think the most Catholic response is to try to say, where are the areas that we can honor caregiving? I think that's one possible approach, and one that gets away from maybe some of the culture war stuff that I think has been not only notably unsuccessful and actually anti-successful, but also has made it seem as if the church thinks that the reason that the U.S. has gay marriage now is that gay people have perversely decided to continue existing. And then there are a couple of questions that are sort of along the lines of how can we effectively relate to or evangelize gay Catholics and be welcoming? Are there any specific best practices you've seen which could be replicated? There's a few really basic things. One of them is just to say the word gay. I'm a coordinator for the gay and lesbian ministry at my church, and so many people will come up to us and say, you know, it was amazing to me to see the word gay in the bulletin, or to hear the priest when he's making the announcement say, this is our gay and lesbian ministry. And you'll often hear that their child is gay, or that they have another relative or friend who's gay, who has really felt their whole lives that there was no place in the church and no recognition that people like them even existed. This is something like Pope Francis, I think, realizes. One of the things that was so powerful about his statement, if a gay person is sincerely seeking God, who am I to judge? One of the reasons I think that resonated with so many people was that it was obvious that he was thinking about gay people as people in the pews, as normal, ordinary people in the church, not outside it. So I think that's like, at every opportunity, you can ask yourself, what would this church look like if we knew that there were gay people here? A friend of mine, who I interviewed for a story a while ago, said, you know, if you don't have gay couples coming to your church, that in itself is a problem. It's a signal that you're not seen as being Jesus. Jesus was not, right, like, followed by the people who already were living out the Christian way of life. He was followed by people who saw something attractive in his mercy, his presence, maybe they didn't even know what they saw, but they saw something that drew them to him, even before they were willing to even begin thinking about doing everything that he told people to do. I'm rambling. Other best practices that I have seen. Again, I'm sorry to keep harping on the same chord, but I think the more you emphasize other forms of love, and act like you know that not everybody in your parish is going to grow up to get married, the more you will begin to be perceived as a somewhat safer place for people to come out. Having a sermon on friendship, that can be having a small group discussion on friendship, that can be a visit to a monastery, organizing that. That can be, showing of gods and men. I suggested showing this for Valentine's Day. As a sort of, what is love? Those are things that I think would work well. That's all I've got at the moment. But I really think, like, it's more of in terms of the framework. If the thing that you always have in your head is, there are gay people who are hearing me speak. Is there anything that they can take away from my words? That can be really helpful. Another example, a lot of the topics that we talk about anyway have some unique or specific relevance to the gay community. So, for example, if you're talking about, like, ways that you can harm other people by speaking, you can say, well, gossip, right, is something that we've all had to sort of grapple with. You can say, when you get really angry and lose your temper at something. And also, when you use anti-gay slurs, and just, like, this quick little thing, I think sends a powerful signal to anyone around you who has not yet felt ready or safe to come out, and you'll be the person that they'll come to talk to. And then you can begin asking them, what would you need to see from us to feel more like this was your home? I think maybe that's the biggest thing to take away, is just to sort of make it obvious that you are a safe person to talk to, because then the people who actually know what they need are the gay people themselves. So at that point, you're just sort of going to be listening, but you have to be available. You have to be sort of obviously open and available first. What is your opinion of using the term gay versus same-sex attracted? I actually wanted to get into this, and did ran out of time, or sort of, ran out of memory. One of the huge things that I learned since doing, that I thought already when I wrote the book, but the importance of it has only grown in my mind, is how many vocabularies and types of spirituality are fully Catholic. How much diversity there is within Orthodoxy. And that's true, like, if you're a Carmelite, I wouldn't understand Carmelite spirituality if you, like, funneled it directly into my brain. But I get that it's a thing that people do. And similarly, I think with the terminology that we use for cultural stuff like sexual orientation. I don't think sexual orientation is an eternal, everlasting category. I think in 100 years, there's a good chance that we will no longer be talking in terms of gay and straight, that just won't be a category that we focus on in the same way or that we define in the same way. But it is where we are at the moment. When I use it, I'm basically describing a community, I think. Gay is a community that I'm a part of, that I belong to. It's a culturally contingent community. It's like being an American. You wouldn't say, like, you know, well, do you think that St. Elwood was an American? These things didn't exist. These categories were not how people divided up the world. Do you think Plato was a liberal? Like, this is not a question that makes sense. So similarly, you know, when you're saying that you're gay, for me, it's embedding myself in a particular historical moment and being accountable to that moment. Standing in solidarity with a stigmatized and marginalized group that I belong to. But that's in part because my experiences in the gay community have been so positive. I think for some people, when their experiences are more negative, it actually is important for them to separate, at least for a time in their lives, from that community. I've also had people tell me that they felt like gay was becoming almost a competing loyalty. It was competing with their loyalty to Christ. If that's where you are in life, then yeah, you need to start moving away from that, de-emphasizing it, and sometimes changing the way you talk about it can really help with that. So I basically, like, the short version of that extremely long-winded answer is that people pick the terms that they pick for different reasons, often to signal a community that they belong to. And if what's most fruitful for your own spirituality is to use the term same-sex attractive, if that defines a community that you do belong to or that you want to embed yourself in more deeply and be accountable to, absolutely, I think that's the right term for you. If, by contrast, the community that you're already most deeply embedded in or that you seek to be more accountable to is the gay community, then I think you should probably use that term. What immediate or practical things can a parish or church community do to make itself more open to estranged gay Christians and inquirers? Some of this overlaps with what I said before, but the big thing that I wanted to re-emphasize is just when people come to the church with questions, don't assume that their questions are all about their sexual orientation. Don't assume that their questions are all about their sex lives. Let people bring to you what they're most interested in. Be honest and upfront with them, but, you know, let them lead in terms of what's most important and where they're willing to move forward, where they're willing to take the church seriously, and where they're like, you've got to be joking. You don't necessarily need to talk about the you've got to be joking stuff all at once. I think we do so much harm when we assume that the cultural category that's most relevant to us from the outside is the one that's most relevant to an inquirer from the inside. So yeah, I guess fewer assumptions that what we need to talk to gay people about when they come to the church is gay stuff. How can the church provide welcoming community to gay Catholics who choose to marry or adopt children? I think two things that are really helpful are if your parish is able to provide individualized spiritual direction. Because you don't want to try to do discipleship by community, which often becomes discipleship by gossip. You want to have people who have a specific individual relationship to this person or couple, who can listen to them, who can hear what they're going through, understand where they're really pushing themselves as hard as they can, and where they can maybe go a little further. You need people who understand that very often what looks from the outside like you're not even trying can look from the inside like, it costs so much for me to even come back to church after what I've been through here. So people who are compassionate, individualized, and I will say, in addition to that, it would do everybody a world of good if we re-emphasize making a spiritual communion. Not everybody has to go out for communion all the time, and it is often a really good thing. It is a way of witnessing to your complex but real and beautiful love of the church. If your situation is not such that you are really in a position to receive communion, acknowledging that and making a spiritual communion is one of the most kind of like humble and, to my mind, really beautiful things that you can do. It is a way of saying that you are still working out what your relationship with the church needs to be, or that you may not trust the church to guide your life, but you trust the church to define her own life. So I think reemphasizing that as a possibility gives people a lot more space to kind of work out their own questions and their life situations. It makes it possible to be in the church even before you've said, like, yeah, I'm going to sign on the dotted line and wave the flag the whole way. And that I think, obviously applies to a lot more issues than just this one. How do you recommend we approach political issues, e.g. gay marriage, in a loving yet truthful way? I generally think look for everything that you can affirm. Often that will mean putting yourself out there. Like, the church and straight people need to sacrifice more, need to put themselves out there more, and to find places of common ground. So, like, honoring caregiving is a place of common ground that would require some difficult thinking on the parts of Catholic institutions as to how they would structure their family leave policies, their health insurance policies, etc. I've had a lot of people ask me, I tried to work with the gay group at my campus or my school on anti-gay violence, and they acted like I was just sort of softening them up, that I was, like, trying to convert them. And, maybe sometimes that's true, right? Sometimes we do approach people with more of an agenda. So I think finding places where you can wholeheartedly say, I'm going to be in this, I'm going to do this action against anti-gay violence because anti-gay violence is wrong and goes against the gospel. So basically I would say in any political issue, find the stuff that you can affirm. Affirm it in ways that are costly to you. And at that point, I think you will start to find that there's more room for agreement than you might have seen possible. Beyond that, like, the church is beautiful. Put her beauty out there. There is so much that throughout history, so many gay or same-sex attracted people have responded to in the Catholic Church. Why was that? There was a period in time in the late 19th century when, especially in Victorian England, where it was actually sort of assumed that if you were same-sex attracted, the obvious church you would be drawn to was the Catholic Church. It was the church of the artists and the church of the then-budding homosexual movement. Why is that? I think a huge part of it is that it was a place where you not only had so much beauty in the liturgy, for example, but you also had specifically forms of same-sex love that were spiritualized, that were understood on a spiritual level. The love of Jesus for John, the love of Christian men for Jesus, the love of Christian women for the bride of Christ, and the devotion of Christian women to Mary. I'm not saying this was sexual stuff. I'm saying that if your heart is attuned to same-sex love in a more intense way than most people's, a lot of these forms of love will resonate with you. And these are often more mystical, more intimate, more intense in the Catholic faith. This is not a political solution, but I think maybe putting more of that out there, more of the kind of the fire of mystical love for Jesus and for the church as the bride of Christ would help us in showing that in kind of like the extremely countercultural statement that not only are there forms of love that are not sexual love, but that sexual love itself is really only one kind of shadow or image of the love between God and the human soul. Sort of answered that already. Someone is asking about people who are seeking sex changes, sexual reassignment surgery, or people who are transgender. I actually personally think this is theologically a separate question. I don't feel super competent to address it. I think what I've been telling everyone, which is sort of sad, is the best Catholic writing that I've seen on this subject is by a woman named Melinda Selmys, S-E-L-M-Y-S, who self-identifies as genderqueer. She's Orthodox, faithful Catholic. She's married and has like a zillion children. And she writes really powerfully and has done a lot of research, both looking at the quantitative scientific evidence and also just interviewing lots and lots and lots of Christian transgender people about their experiences of faith and sexuality. So, like, I hate to do this to sort of pass the buck, but I actually think she's a much better and more credible speaker on that subject than I am. What were you most drawn to in the Catholic Church? So a lot of this is in the book. I think in part it's such a like tabloid church. Like, it's very lurid, very bloody, very like the world is so bad that God had to die. I think that's a big part of it that resonates with me. And yet at the same time, again, so beautiful. And I'll say this wasn't something I articulated to myself when I became Catholic, but I don't think I would have stayed in the church if it were not for her constant attention to and taking the side of the oppressed and the marginalized. The last shall be first, I think, is a huge part of what makes me Catholic, what makes the church credible, if we're getting back to that question. And then somebody who wasn't here for the whole thing, but wanted me to summarize it in one sentence. This will be the last one that I do. How can I summarize in one sentence? Far too often when we address the question of gay people and the Catholic Church, we think that the question is, why shouldn't gay people have sex with each other? When in fact, by far the most pressing question for their lives is, how can I give and receive love?
Eve, thank you so much for your insightful and frankly beautiful Blessed John Duns Scotus defines beauty as the intersection between truth and goodness, and tonight's presentation was certainly beautiful, so thank you. We have some upcoming things. First of all, if you haven't filled out your evaluations, the little blue forms, I ask you to please do so. Secondly, I am a bit remiss to give a special welcome. Welcome to our deaf community who is here. Thank you for being with us. Welcome. So in addition to our Theology on Tap family, so you are most welcome to the expanded young adult community. So we have a few things coming up in the diocese. We have a talk on Thursday, January 28th, the Feast of St. Thomas Aquinas, interestingly, Welcoming the Stranger, Life as a Refugee and the Process of Resettlement, featuring Mustafa Aldori, Patrick Barry, Francis Kaplan, and Caitlin Jones. So there's some flyers about an upcoming event. Also, from February 5th to 7th, we have our Young Adults Retreat at the Marianist Family Retreat Center in Cape May. Come pray, reflect, and laugh. There's forms, more information about Young Adult Retreat. It's a beautiful center just about two blocks from Cape May Point. Then finally, get out your calendars for our next in our Theology on Tap series of No